So, if you're sitting comfortably, I shall begin. I'll go for the bottom ones first of all, because they may be in the ones from last night, which I didn't have time to finish. So here we are. Dear Ajahn Brahm, the following Sinhalese words are widely used in Sri Lanka. Die for sure. And I can understand that. Maranyaya Niyati. Tewan Saranai. That, I know what that means. That means blessings. So, Maranaya Niyatai. Anyway, we're in Australia now, so you say, I will die, that's for sure. Makes life easier. Are fear and guilt associated with conceit? If so, they only disappear when becoming an arahat. Fear and guilt. Not guilt, because I certainly know that guilt is overcome a lot of times with stream winning. Because the stream winning insight is where you see there's no self in here. But there is just a process. And just that process, you know, keeps going on and on and on from moment to moment to moment to moment. And there's no sense of, say, like ownership or no sense of thinking that you know, that thing which you did in the past, you don't have to be. Your idea of perfection changes. Because when there is a sense of self there, the view of, you know, having to be perfect is very, very strong. But when you realize there's no self there, it's just a process. There's no way it will ever be perfect. There'll always be faults in it because it's all conditioned and you can't do anything about it. So usually with the understanding of non-self, a lot of guilt disappears. And of course, there's fears. There's two different types of fears. The fears which are obviously just sensible fears, like the Buddha said, the fear of a snake, the fear of a fire. And, you know, no sort of rational person would actually, except Ajahn Gunha, would go on patting snakes. If you see a snake, you know, you'd avoid it. So there is those fears which are there all the time. There's other fears which are obviously just fears which are defilements, like, you know, the fear of death, for example, is a defilement, because you're going to die anyway. Being afraid of it is not going to stop it. In fact, it makes it worse. And there's many other fears which we have in life which are just irrational, they're not very helpful or useful. So with fears you've got to separate them into two different categories. The fears which are wise fears and the fears which are counterproductive. They don't really protect you, they just create you more problems and difficulties. But as far as guilt is concerned, I think all types of guilt is not really helpful. When I say all forms of guilt, it doesn't mean that one doesn't have a sense of remorse sometimes, in the sense, oh, I wish I hadn't have done that. But, as you all heard me say so many times, if you have done something wrong, kicking yourself, beating yourself, thinking I'm a terrible person, that doesn't help at all. Whenever you make a mistake, number one, you acknowledge it. You own up to it. There's nothing wrong with making mistakes. It's part of life. Is there anyone here who's never made a mistake? When I asked that some years ago, someone put their hand up and they said, I made a mistake, they said. Many years ago, I thought I made a mistake. That's the only mistake I've ever made. Conceding. But now we all make mistakes from time to time, but why do we hide them? Why do we, are we embarrassed about when we make mistakes? That is a bit of conceit. But if one can just own up, yeah, I made a mistake, I blew it. Because you own up and acknowledge it, then there can be learning happening. But if you don't acknowledge it because of the punishment, the guilt, then you never actually realize what you're doing wrong. You always hide it. Which means there's never any growth. Which is why the Buddha kept saying again and again that any fault which you make, acknowledge it, forgive it, which helps acknowledging because there's no punishment, and learn from it. So, you learn either not to do it again, or more importantly, not to put yourself in a position where you have to do it again. Because lots of times in life we're in, as I say, between a rock and a hard place, and we don't know what to do. We sort of break our precepts, do wrong things, because we put ourselves in difficult situations. Like, Buddhists, on New Year's Eve, they go to a party with their friends instead of come to Ajahn Brahm's party. And you put yourself in a position where everyone else is drinking, and maybe your boss, and maybe think, come on, take a drink. And sometimes it's difficult to say no because you put yourself in a difficult situation. For those of you who are in those situations and you try to keep off the alcohol, the story of one of the disciples here in Perth, he started becoming a Buddhist, keeping the five precepts, and when he went to a party for some function at work, and he said, no, I can't drink alcohol anymore, I'm a Buddhist, he said. And his friends knew enough about Buddhism to say, oh, Buddhism is a great religion. In Buddhism, it's all about letting go. Come on, let go and have a drink. They know it's about letting go, but they're not quite sure, what letting go means. So, he was forced to having a drink. And so later on, he said, I found this other way, this other method of being able to go to the parties and not taking any alcohol. I said, what was that? He said, whenever people offer me a drink, I say, sorry, I can't drink, doctor's orders. I said, I didn't think there's anything wrong with you. He said, there's nothing wrong with me, I'm perfectly fit. And he said, aren't you keeping one precept by breaking another, by lying? And that's where he reminded me that in the suttas, many times the Buddha compared himself to a doctor. So the fellow was right, it's doctor's orders, Dr. Buddha's orders. That's why he couldn't drink. He never said Dr. Buddha's orders, he just said doctor's orders. And that means he could get away with not drinking. Very skillful means. But if you do something wrong, the guilt is counterproductive. You don't grow or get better through practicing guilt. Acknowledge it, you made a mistake, accept the fact you're not perfect, we're all growing. And little by little we learn. And we learn not to put ourselves in that position, or learn to find some strategies so we don't have to do wrong, bad things. And that means that we grow, which means the problem disappears. Next one. Thank you for teaching us with an open hand. You're awesome. Yes, I said, when you come on retreats, I use the open hand. Slap, slap, slap. What do you do? How's your meditation? No, we don't do interrogations over here. We just do. So So don't even be afraid of coming on the interviews. This afternoon there's no one on the interviews. I had the afternoon off. But I didn't feel guilty that I wasn't teaching you. I just enjoyed myself instead. I enjoyed myself teaching as well. I can tell, here we go. Just a comment rather than a question. Many years ago, I did a weekend retreat at the old place in Safety Bay. You know, it was actually on Penguin Road. And there were nuns there. And I thought that's what they named the Penguin Road after. Because of the nuns. That's a joke. Okay, never mind. What do nuns look like? Penguin. So, okay, never mind. Years ago, at the old place in Safety Bow, Penguin Road, where the nuns lived, long before Jhana Grove were even conceived, having to share a bedroom with another person who snored, having to hold in my farts, using they're being quite gross, but it's funny. Using communal bathroom like a boarding school and a very cramped and dark meditation room, I spent the whole time anxious and exhausted. That means like passing wind, being exhausted. What a nightmare. It's late at night, we've had a hard day. Come on, give me a break. You know, I don't feel guilty about telling bad jokes. You know, just don't put me in a position where I have to do that again. Jhana Grove rocks. I am very grateful for this place. I still cannot meditate to save my life. Couldn't recognize it even if it ran over me. And Jhana's just a pretty girl's name. Jhana over there. That lady over there, the girl is Jhana, known as she's very small. So if any of you have never experienced or seen Jhana before, just have a look over there. And you can go home and you'd say, yes, I saw Jhana on Ajahn Brahm's retreat. So thank you for coming. So now everyone can say that they've actually experienced Jhana. just a pretty girl's no PTO, but I have experienced some peace while here, and that is good enough. Excellent. You should keep experiencing peace and more peace and more peace and more peace. And then you build up enough peace, and that becomes the jhanas. You're just building up the peace, building up the peace, building up the peace. And thank you to Jhana Grove, to myself, Bianca, caretakers, dana givers, donors, etc., etc. And it is a nice place here because, you know, I love meditation so much, as you all know, and I want to share that joy and that insight with other people. And it does. It's very difficult if you have to share with another person. Now, everybody tries their best, but with another person, sometimes there's noises or they chat and stuff like that. It's even worse in some places where you have to stay in a dormitory with about five or six other people. I really feel sorry for people. They don't get enough sleep at night, so when they come here to meditate, they know they have sloth and torpor. They can't really get into the meditation. And it's because we value meditation so much that we built the place like this. Everyone has their own room and own ensuite. And I like telling people, I fought tooth and nail to get those en-suites for every meditator. People thought, oh, we can't afford it. But of course, eventually you can afford things and it's worth it. It gives you that comfort. So you can meditate in your room, you've got your toilet, you don't have to queue up. And it's so comfortable, it takes away a lot of fear, not a lot of the reason why people don't meditate. It's comfortable here. Which means you get far better results in meditation. And anyway, you guys paid for it. I just, was building it and just organizing it. So you deserve to be here. So welcome and enjoy it. And I'm trying to also to set the standard for retreat centers and other places. Some people always think that in retreats you've got to be strict and it's got to be painful. You know, and as if like endurance is the only way to understand the Four Noble Truths. But yeah, I mean, the first Noble Truth is suffering. What about the other three Noble Truths? The end of suffering especially. And people in our world today, even with a comfortable life in the West, we know enough suffering. What we don't know is the end of suffering. And so we come here to try and find the end of suffering. If you want to find suffering, then just go home. But here we want to find the end of suffering. So we make this very comfortable. And it works. It makes meditation much, much better. And also, Now, it's all run by volunteers, which is wonderful. Now, the people who bring the food for you, they come all the way from Perth, and they cook incredible food for you, and they don't get any money out of this. This is their dharma. And so this is a place which is run for so cheaply. It's the booking bond was $225. You could stay in a backpacker's place for one night, or maybe a couple of nights with that amount of money. And that's important, that we don't think about the money, we're thinking about making it possible for everybody, poor people, rich people, anybody can come here. And because it's all done by volunteers. That's one of the reasons why, you have to do a bit of chores, but it's only a small amount. And it's wonderful, sometimes you get some people here who actually are really rich, and at home they have maids, and they've never done washing up before in their lives. And they come here, and they really enjoy washing up. I say, we don't get to do that back in Singapore or in Malaysia where we come from. And here, I can do washing up. Woohoo! They really enjoy it. And it means they're part of the place, and it means we can keep the costs down. Which means that everyone can come, and some people who really are quite poor, it's the best they can do. So this is, as my predecessor, Ajahn Chakra, he always used to say, the cheapest and the best. And this is, Jhana Grove is, the cheapest and the best. He would send me out to go and get something for the monastery. He said, which one should I get? He said, get the cheapest and the best. Thank you, that's not very helpful, because the cheapest is usually the worst. He wanted the best and the cheapest. Really a hard person to please, but I know what he meant. But this is the cheapest and the best. So it's wonderful that every one of you have contributed, each in your own way, to this place. Thank you. Dear Ajahn, to become a stream winner, at least we have to get first jhana. What happens if we can't get jhana? Even nimitta we can't attain, but we keep good our five precepts and be kind. Don't ever say you can't get jhanas. It doesn't matter how many times you've been in this retreat. It's always add the three letters YET. You haven't got jhanas yet. But don't say, I can't. Because you know the psychology. If you think you can't do something, you never will. So I always like to say, you haven't done it yet. But it doesn't mean you can't do it. And this is one of the wonderful things that as long as you've been born a human being, which you all have, and that you haven't done what, in Buddhism they call the antarayaka karmas, like killing your parents, causing a schism in the Sangha, taking the blood of a Buddha. The Buddha's passed away, so you can't do those things. It's usually the only thing you can really do, the antarayaka karmas, is like killing your parents. You haven't done that. Then there's no obstacle between you and enlightenment. It's there for you. You can do that. So because of that, each one of you here, it's possible for you to get jhanas and to get enlightened. And sometimes, you wonder who can and who can't. And even I get it wrong many times. I like to say about, was it the Easter retreat this year? I think it was the Easter retreat. Could have been earlier. That one person came on this retreat here in Jhana Grove, and when I saw him, I judged him, and I thought, this guy's come to the wrong place, because he had long hair and lots of tattoos. I thought, aren't you supposed to be visiting your friends in the prison up the road? That's what I thought. It was my mistake. I was stupid. I judged him just because of his looks. This really rough guy. He did look like he came from like a bikey gang, like a Hell's Angel. But he was the one who got the jhanas that retreat. I just couldn't believe it. In the interviews, this really rough guy, long hair, tattoos all over him, and he started talking about his meditation. And I was just stunned. Now, he was getting these incredible meditations, and I don't say it very easily, that a person has jhana, but that was a clear case of, you got the jhanas. And so, if he can attain the jhanas, surely you guys can. And you can. It's just a matter of just pressing the letting go button in the right way, and it just happens. So never think you can't. It's the similes, which is very hard for me to make similes, but one simile which I came up with years ago. It's like you're trying to cross a river. And it's not that wide a river, but you're always going up along the banks or down the banks, until one day you realize to cross the river you have to go in another direction, perpendicular. And you've never gone that way before. It's always along the bank, you know, going up the bank or down the bank, but never across. And that's what it is, a slight change of perception. And you find you can actually stride across the river. It's so easy once you see how to do it. But for years and years and years, you're going to be going up the bank, down the bank, trying to find a way across. You don't realize, turn around, go a different direction and step over, and it's really easy. This is one of the reasons why the people practice for years and years and years and years and get nowhere. And then one day that they get it, they understand, and they just cross and they just get into jhanas and get insights. We're so close. But we can spend years being close and never just making that last step. So that's the best simile I can give you. And it's pretty accurate. So never think you can't, just you haven't yet. Dear Ajahn, when meditating I feel there's a force pulling me, sometimes to the side, sometimes swirling up and down. Is this common or my imagination? Thank you for Tadashi showing us the path. That's actually quite common, to feel forces in the body. And never resist them, just watch them, see what happens. After a while they sort of settle down and you sort of become very still. Sometimes it's the case that when I call these states, when perception gets its wings, it's like your perception, this ability to understand the world or your experiences, perceive it this way or that way, is so heavily conditioned. You're actually taught what you're allowed to perceive and what you can't perceive. And when you start to meditating, those constraints get removed and you start to experience weird stuff. You know, like energies through your body, or your body swirling around, or like rising up into the air, or exploding, or becoming incredibly fat. And you know, when those things happen, there's no problem at all. Just enjoy them and just go for the ride and see what happens next. It's weird stuff, but totally safe. And own experiences, when I was meditating in Thailand, I'm a very young monk, but getting some nice meditation, I remember going past the washing place and seeing some towels hanging on the line to dry. And I stopped because one of the towels was jet black. And I've never seen a black towel before. And so it's like rubbing my eyes, you know. Are you imagining this, a black towel? That's weird. And I stared at that black towel for about 3 or 4 minutes, and then it changed colour into white again. And I thought, this is very strange. What's going on there? Another time I was washing a wall, and the wall started to melt, like it was like chocolate on a hot day. And I thought, is somebody put some drugs in my food or whatever, what's going on? But all it really is that, you know, you are taught to perceive things only in one way. And you get to a stage of meditation where many of the hindrances have been removed and those constraints and controls are taken away. And the mind plays around. It shows you images of things in a totally different way than you've ever seen before. Like white becomes black, and solid becomes water as it melts. And what is small becomes big. And this is just showing you just how perception is so controlled. And when you take off those controls, perception goes wild and shows you different ways of looking at the same thing. Ways which you thought were impossible, but you see those. And after playing around for a while, it settles down. You get really, really peaceful afterwards. But meditation can be quite boring. You're sitting here just watching breath go in, breath go out. You know, itipiso, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. It was fun when we first did it, but after a while, whew, can't we do something else? And meditation can be boring. But when you get to these states where perception really starts to play around, it gets really interesting and fun. And I mention this because don't get scared when this happens. Enjoy it. It's a bit of fun and games for the mind to play around. It's perfectly safe. Except if you interrupt it. Because once, I was meditating and I had this perception of my body expanding and expanding and expanding. And then I interrupted it, opened my eyes, and it got stuck like this ever since. That's another of my excuses. So I see if you can perceive things in a different way. And that's what it is. So when that happens, just let it happen and just enjoy it. Don't be afraid. See what happens next. Be adventurous in meditation. Let the perception just do its thing. Dear Arjuna, I can totally relate to what the Buddha meant when he said, not getting what you want is suffering. But I don't understand what he meant when he said, getting what you want is also suffering. Could you please explain? He didn't actually say that, but that was actually, I think Voltaire said that, the great French philosopher. I think it was Voltaire. There's only two tragedies in life. Oh no, it's Oscar Wilde, the British guy. Oscar Wilde. There's only two tragedies in life. The first tragedy is not getting what you want. And the second tragedy is getting what you want. And it's very wise, because all those things you want, you think, once I get them, then I'll be satisfied and happy. But when you get them, you find it's not what you expected. And you're still not happy. And sometimes the search, expectation and hope is what keeps many people going. And that's their life. It's just no hope. And when actually they get to the end of the road and they feel that it's not what they wanted, that can be very, very, very dispiriting. And so, that was Oscar Wilde said those things, that the two sufferings in life, the first is not getting what you want, the second is getting what you want. Once you get it, is it really what you needed? It can be very disappointing. There was one girl. It was a marriage day. I think I was blessing her marriage. And at the end of the marriage, she said, this is supposed to be the happiest day of my life. Is this it? If this is so happy, it's like, oh God, what's coming afterwards? That's a very good reflection of that lady. It's not a bit depressing, but nevertheless. But there was also, I remember these people telling me curses, in different cultures. And they told me these two curses from the Middle East. Now, the Arabs are really good at cursing. And the first one was very inventive. And the second one was really profound. And the first curse I heard from the Middle East was, if you don't like someone, you tell them, may the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. That's really nasty, but it's got some sort of class and style to it. It's imaginative. But the worst curse of all, apparently, was, may you get whatever you want as soon as you want it. When I heard that, I thought, wow, somebody understands the Dhamma. May you get whatever you want as soon as you want it. And you'll find much of what you think of as life gets destroyed. There's no struggle, there's no hope, there's no working hard to get something, no achievement. As soon as you want it, you get it. Could you stand that? For many people, they would hate that. They wouldn't know what to do. They're not ready for such a thing. So that's one of the reasons why sometimes it's better not to get what you want. It's what life is all about. Life is a journey from where you are to where you want to go. If you're already there, no more life. But that's also something to do with nibbana, but you can't really accept that until you see non-self. So it's very true. Getting what you want is also suffering. You get totally disappointed. Is this it? So many people, they want to go to heaven. And many people, when they get to heaven, get terribly disappointed. They go to heaven there. They want to be happy ever after. They find their ex is up there. How can you actually do that? Because people get married two or three times. Imagine what it's going to be like there. You know, for a good reason, you know, you get married and maybe your wife dies young, so you marry another girl. And then when you go to heaven, which one are you going to live with? You know, they're going to argue. And what's heaven going to be there? What about, you know, you want your cat to be in heaven? Because, you know, you really love your cat, but your wife also wants a dog in heaven. So it might be good for you, but the poor old cat being chased around by the dog every day, that's not going to be very nice. But basically, the whole idea of heaven just doesn't make any sense at all. But people actually aspire towards that. And so because of that, that's why they sort of get very disappointed when they get what they want. It's not what they expected. Oh, okay. Dear Ajahn, do you believe you were a Buddhist in your previous lives? How can we make sure we are born as a Buddhist or at least have access to Buddha's teachings in our next life so that we can improve our practice? Look, it's usually quite obvious, you know, that I was a Buddhist before. You know, just why on earth am I the only person in my family who became a Buddhist? No one else even knew how to spell the word Buddhist, let alone become a Buddhist. You just gravitated towards it. And it wasn't that I just was converted. The first book I read on Buddhism, I realized I was a Buddhist. Had all those ideas. And I just didn't know what they were called. And so for you to have access to the Buddhist teachings in your next life, I mean, I had some bad karma from my previous life. And my bad karma from my previous life caused me to be born in England. Cold country. Depressing. Bad food. It's a long way away from Buddhism. So that was some really bad karma I must have done to get born in that place. I should have been born in a Buddhist country. It's much better fun. And anyway, to have access to the Buddhist teachings in your next life is you're inclining towards the Buddhist teachings. You practice a lot in this life. You go to Buddhist temples, read Buddhist books, do Buddhist things. And of course you're going to incline towards them in the next life. Just, you know, that's just your inclination. That's what attracts you. And those karmic forces which you build and build and build and build and build over many, many years, of course they're going to have power. Much more power than just one stupid act which you think, oh, I killed an arahat, therefore I'm going to be in big trouble. That's only one act. What about all the rest of the stuff you do in your life? That is really important. So if you go to retreats and go to temples and just hang out with other Buddhists, of course you're going to be a Buddhist in the next life. That's where you belong. Dear Ajahn Brahm, why do the people look miserable when meditating? Exactly. It's okay for you. I see all of you when I open my eyes. Oh, crikey. Why can't they be pleased like you? What that little child said is true, zombies. Is it they are trying harder to activate the higher state of mind? No. Please explain. I like them to be pleasant to look at. Okay, everybody, in the morning, 20 push-ups. Lunchtime, 20 push-ups. Evening, 20 push-ups. You know my 20 push-ups? 1, 2, 3, 4. Do some smiling meditation or smiling practice. So if, and seriously, when you are meditating, if the meditation is not really getting happy, just take your attention away from whatever you're watching, breath, nimittas, I don't know, whatever you're watching, put it on your mouth and smile. Just fake a smile if you can't make a natural one. Because as soon as your mouth smiles, you know, just forcing it, that brings a little bit of happiness into the mind. Then you go back to your meditation object and you find it is actually happier. You can actually do it much better. So this is a meditation technique which I use of actually getting into some happiness when you're meditating by going to the mouth, making it smile, and then you feel happy. Dear Ajahn, Lungpo Mahabua had mentioned that one has to do panya after samadhi. He equates panya as hard work. Thus one has to regain energy afterwards in samadhi and then resume working panya again. Is insert work tiring for the mind? Anything is tiring if you force it. And that was actually Ajahn Mahabua's weakness. because I remember the one, I stayed 7 days with that monk some time ago, and while he was there, he gave a talk in Thai, especially for me. I was fluent in Thai, I understood everything about it, and it was translated afterwards because Ajahn Mahabodhi didn't realize I was fluent in Thai. And it was actually translated, I've seen it in one of his books afterwards. And it's okay, that's doing, there's a little frog there doing this walking meditation. We do kangaroo jumping meditation, this is frog jumping meditation. So please leave it over there, it's a very happy little frog, just coming and listening to the Dhamma. And Ajahn Mahabodhi said this story, and it shows actually just the difference between real insight and just forcing it. Because he said that he once had malaria, everyone had malaria, but the character of this monk, Mahabodhi, was just this fighter. So even though he was in the middle of a malaria attack, it was the chores time, the bell rang, and he thought, no, I'm going to be tough. So even though his body was shaking with the fever, he got up, picked up a broom, and started sweeping in the middle of a malaria fever attack. Now his willpower was immense. And as soon as his teacher, as Ajahn Mun, saw him, he blasted him, you stupid monk, this is not what a monk is supposed to do, fighting things. A monk is supposed to contemplate things. Go and lay down and contemplate your fever, don't try and defeat it. And that is what the insight is. You don't fight things, you learn from them. And coming from him, that was a wonderful little teaching. So the work of actually wisdom is nothing you do. If you fight it, then you get tired. You just contemplate it. In other words, you sit there and learn from it, like a teacher. So it was actually our teaching you. And so that is how wisdom works, not through force. If it's force, you get stressed and tired. And I don't know why this is the case, but I always remember the first time I went to Malaysia, and people were complaining, because they knew I was a meditation teacher, and they say, how can you cure meditation headache? Samadhi headache, they said. I said, what? Samadhi headache, everybody has it. I don't have it. This is the first time I heard that people get headaches when they meditate. My goodness, meditation is supposed to make you healthy and peaceful and calm. And then I realized just how much effort they were putting into their meditation. And they're getting so stressed out, they're getting headaches when they're meditating. So I thought, this is really wrong. So you don't fight, you don't do hard work. Insight, calm, it's just the easiest thing in the world to do. You sit and listen. You don't talk back. It's like you listen to the Dharma teaching you. It's teaching you in every moment. Talking back, trying to control it, trying to decide what you're going to learn and how you're going to learn it, that causes headaches. So real insight comes automatically, as the Buddha said. There's a lovely sutra in the Anguttara. And basically the Buddha, it was translated, I think, by many people, and the title is usually Enlightenment is a Natural Process. And it says, for someone, say, who is happy, they don't have to decide and put forth effort and say, oh, may my mind enter jhanas. It's natural. Happy minds enter jhanas. And one who's had jhanas, they don't have to force or decide or make effort, oh, may I see the Dhamma. So it happens naturally. One who is in jhanas or has bad jhanas will see the Dhamma. It's cause and effect. Nothing to do with you. And that is a very beautiful teaching of the Buddha. This is nature, cause and effect. You don't do it. It's just one thing leads to another, which leads to another, and that's you're enlightened. That's how it works. So don't do hard work. If you do hard work, you get stressed out, you're going in the wrong direction. Meditation is very easy and peaceful and calm and wonderful, and you get incredible insights that way. Now, he has not mentioned any states of jhana, but stresses insights. Can you share your thoughts on this? Yeah, imagine Mahabodhi did do jhanas, So no, very, very still and peaceful. But he used lots of force to do it. Dear Ajahn Brahm, a breakthrough today. I decided to put the effect before the cause. I said to my body, when did you most feel free? As memories of my body feeling free arose, my breathing deepened and I felt more energized. The more I breathed in sensual bodily pleasure, the more an inhibitor appeared and stabilized. It seemed like the body pleasure was an inhibitor pump. Later I realized that I had been confused about sensory desire versus sensory bodily pleasure. Bliss, thank you. P.S. Not a dirty tea towel. In other words, you had a nice inhibitor. Well done. It is true that sometimes people are afraid and they don't understand the difference between, you know, what we call the pleasures which make you attached and the pleasures of the mind which keep you free. And the pleasures of meditation are totally different than the pleasures of the mind, which is one of the reasons why the Buddha made that distinction. He made it very clearly in the Ranavibhanga Sutra. He said, you know which pleasures should be followed and which pleasures should be avoided. And it's the pleasures of the five senses, of beautiful sights, sounds, smells, tastes and touches. They can be avoided, but the pleasures of the mind, they should be developed and followed. And that's what you're doing in meditation. The pleasure of letting go, the pleasure of keeping precepts, the pleasure of doing dana, the pleasure of seeing other people do dana, like all these people who feed us. That gives you so much pleasure and just inspiration to see this happening. Those are pleasures which we should cultivate. You know, but the pleasure of really delicious food, I'm going to eat some more, now that's to be avoided. But the pleasures which come from the mind, they're called niramisa, unworldly pleasures, those are to be cultivated. So that's what this person has been doing, been cultivating the pleasure of a relaxed body. And that means that that's creating the sukha, the happiness inside the mind, and you get lovely meditations and also great nimittas as well. So cultivate the pleasure of the mind. Cultivate inspiration. And if you're really dull when you're sitting here, think of, you know, all the people who came together to build this place. And all of you sitting on this side, you know, from the middle out to the wall over there. That floor was laid by the monks the night before the opening. You know, the builders, you know, builders are the same all over Australia. You know, they said, yeah, we finished by January. So we had the opening in April. February, oh, well, no, it's, we said January, but we've done by March. March, oh, well, we should be able to do it by your opening. And the night before, the floor was only half done. And they couldn't get any sort of people to fix the floor in this hall. So, who came to the rescue? Not the 7th Cavalry, but the Sangha. So the monks finished it off. And what time they worked? About 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. They're finishing this off. So what you're sitting off, all you people in here, this was done by monks. Working, 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the morning so that we could have the opening, so we could have a retreat, the first Easter retreat here. And that's really inspiring. So, you know, you're sitting on the sweat of monks, working really late into the night. That's beautiful, that makes you happy. So some of those inspirations which, you know, all the good karma you've done, good karma other people have done, that's free happiness. It's there for you, so use it. And then you get so happy, meditation's easy. Are all Buddhas kind? Yeah. What about advanced meditators? Incredibly kind. Is it possible to be an advanced meditator and not kind? Absolutely not. You can be a fake advanced meditator and not kind, but if you really are an advanced meditator, kindness is just part of it. And it's impossible to be, you know, have wisdom and not be kind. There seems to be a lot of stories in Buddhism about cruel and harsh teachers hitting their students with sticks, etc. They're not advanced. They can't be advanced. And sometimes I see some parts of Buddhism, I get very embarrassed about it. You know, there was, if you haven't heard this story, when I was visiting Hong Kong, because I do travel a lot and I get, you know, Buddhist gossip, you know, find out what's going on in other countries. And in Hong Kong, it's a great melting place of people from mainland China, Korea and Singapore and all over the place. And obviously the West as well, because I was there. And so sitting around having breakfast with a few monks from all over the place and telling stories to each other, And one of the monks said he'd just come back from mainland China, where there was quite a famous teacher was teaching a Zen retreat, where he did go behind everybody with a stick, and if they were nodding, they'd get hit. And he hit one of these middle-aged Chinese women, and as soon as she got hit, she took out her mobile phone, called the police, and had that monk arrested. And the police came and took him away. Because you can't hit people in the modern world on the back. So if you're a Zen teacher and you go to Zen retreats, be careful. You know, you can get done for assault by hitting someone on the back like that. Yeah, having a mobile phone, that's not against the law. It's against the monastery rules, but you know, that's, you know, she actually called up the police and they had no choice, had to arrest him because it was against the law. And when I went to Bhutan last February, I just couldn't believe it. I went into one of these monasteries there, and they said, the tour guide said that they were having an election of one of the Sangha officers, one of the monk officers. Which one was it? It was the disciplined monk. What does he do? We soon found out, because he'd just been appointed, and he came out into the courtyard with his whip and his long stick with his three long thongs. Mahinda, you've got a picture of it over in our city centre. And he whacked it on the ground. All the pigeons flew off. And even I got a bit scared. Because I was told by our guy, he said, even though you don't belong to this monastery, even though you're lay people, you're in the monastery grounds, he has full power to hit you with that whip, if he wants to. And it's illegal. And that was really scary. Because it had these three big leather thongs on it. I mean, that would really hurt. And see, all of our tour group, we all took a few steps backwards to get out of range of this guy. But afterwards, I thought, what on earth is a monk doing whipping people? That is really weird, and that's nothing to do with Buddhism. I read actually, I think, in one of the in-flight magazines on the way out of Bhutan, that sociologists did some research on the Bhutanese monks and found they were highly stressed. You know, much more so than the ordinary people. With that disciplined monk around, I can understand why. But that's not Buddhism. There's something wrong there. The gentleness, the kindness, the compassion, you know, which you read about, which you see in all the stories of the Buddha, which, you know, you see in Buddhists, which you recommend to others and which inspire and make Buddhism a beautiful religion. That was gone in those places. So please, you know, just remember that Buddhism is really kind and compassionate. And that's why that's a brilliant way to meditate. You sit down there and close your eyes, and I love doing this. I imagine I'm a Buddha 2,600 years ago. And how would the Buddha meditate? He did it with such kindness and gentleness and softness, incredible softness, much more than I could ever do. But I, you know, I go in that direction. Imagine I'm a Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree. And just, even though I can't go all that way, I can go far enough with the kindness and the softness and the peace and the lack of desires, not wanting anything, comes up, and then, wow, you start, you're peaceful straight away. You know, you're in a deep meditation just immediately, because, you know, you have some idea and concept of what a Buddha is. And especially if you've grown up in a Buddhist land, you know, it's embedded in you what a Buddha is: kind, soft, not wanting anything. And you get a mind like that, and meditation, you're way ahead from the very beginning as soon as you sit down. Wonderful. So advanced meditator is always kind. Could you perform another miracle and please stop the rain? I wash my undies and they need to dry. No, I am not kind. I'm not going to do it to you. You don't need dry. There is a dryer in the laundry. And actually did that out of kindness to you. Could you please explain in detail about dependent origination? My goodness, that is a very deep question, dependent origination. So, but in brief, dependent origination, like, is mostly about how rebirth happens without a soul. Because that's a question people keep asking. So, And this is Westerners. They say, yeah, and we know you believe in reincarnation, but you also believe there's no soul. So how can you have reincarnation without a soul? For many people, it makes no sense to them. And that's what dependent origination was supposed to be talking about, of how this is a process. And there is one lovely little sutra where the Buddha says, you can't say there is nothing. You can listen to me, you can hear me. There's an arising of experience can be perceived. But you can't say there is something because it lasts momentarily and it's gone again. A falling away is seen. It says the truth of existence is between things existing and things not existing. And it's called the process of dependent origination, a cause and effect process. So that cause and effect process is halfway between existence and nothing. It's a third option. And that is described by dependent origination. When this is, it causes something else. And that causes something else, and that causes something else. It's a whole chain of changes. So there's nothing at the beginning, which is near the end, but there's something happening all the time. And that is a process. And especially saying the process of rebirth. And it is like run by craving, as I mentioned with the simile of a river, a stream of consciousness. That drives the stream of consciousness from moment to moment. It was a craving drove you here. And it's a craving which will drive you into the mind-made body when you die. Now that keeps this process, the stream of consciousness, going. Now it creates even bodies so it can express itself. And so this stream of consciousness, the craving is the force, and these moments of experience, you know, are the stuff which we take to be life. And when this thing we take to be life, you know, these momentary existences, they come together, they move so fast, it gives the same effect as, you know, the old movies. You know, especially the still movies, where the little frames move so quickly that it gives the illusion of continuity. I don't know, you've done those little stick figures on pieces of papers and you flip them through and it looks like the stick figure is running or moving. It's a whole series of still shots which are run so fast that it appears to be moving. But that's the illusion of continuity. And so if you look very carefully, you can see that what we take to be existence is just momentary. And I once described it as looking at a beach. So you go to Cottesloe Beach, the famous beach in Perth, and you think it's a continuous stretch of sand. But you look closer and it's made up of individual pieces of silica. And if you look even closer, you find those little, tiny little bits of sand aren't even touching. The spaces between them. And that's a great simile of this thing we call the streams of consciousnesses. There's so many different moments of consciousness, like little grains of sand. But because we see them from a distance, as it were, we think it's a continuous flow of consciousness. But it's individual, cause and effects. So that is actually the nature, and this is the craving drives it. So, the reason or where we get reborn and how rebirth happens, which is the main part of dependent origination, is actually through the craving. You get reborn where you want to be reborn, and also if you've got the karma to get reborn in such a place. The karma actually limits sort of your craving. So you may want to be reborn sort of as a healthy, wise person, but you may not have the karma for that. In the same way that I say, if you want to go to, say, Bangkok, there is two reasons or two causes have to be fulfilled to get to Bangkok. Number one, you have to want to get there, and number two, you have enough money or passport or ticket to get there, the wherewithal to get there. And if you have the wherewithal but not the wish, you won't get there. If you have the wish to get there but not the wherewithal, you won't arrive there. You need both of those conditions. To want to get there and have the karmic causes. And that's actually how rebirth happens. And a good example of that is this friend here in Perth. Some years ago, I asked him, and he believed in reincarnation, rebirth, so I said, where do you want to be reborn in your next life? And he said, I want to be reborn as a dog in my next life. And as a Buddhist, and especially a Buddhist who spent time in Asia, that was really quite shocking. You want to be reborn as a dog in your next life? What on earth for? And he explained it to me. He said, well, look, in Australia, dogs don't have to go to work on a Monday morning. They get fed incredibly good food, sometimes as good food as their owners get. They get steaks and chops and sausages and chicken. And not dog food anymore. And they get, you know, their hair done. And they get clothes when it's cold. And they just lounge around house all day. They don't have to do anything at all. And they said, it's a pretty good life as a dog. You know, compared to you, you have to work so hard and stress and strive, get to work in the morning and, you know, you don't get what you want to eat sometimes. So imagine being a dog. It's a pretty nice life. So I could see his points. But then I told him also that here in Australia, if you're born as a dog, I forget how many weeks after your birth, but you have to go to the vet to get de-sexed. And when I told him that, he changed his mind. He didn't want to be a dog anymore. But you can see that you have, you know, your huge good karma. You can get much better than a dog, but you choose to be, because that's where you think you're going to have some pleasure and happiness. And that's actually how dependent origination happens. Craving and karma, they're the two main forces which create your next life. So if you can stop the craving, this force of always wanting things, and you can be still, especially when you die, not a want comes up in the mind, then it's like the bus comes to collect you for your next life. And it can't find you, you're too still. So it leaves without you. No more birth. Vajan Brahm, it feels wonderful and looks the most natural thing on earth to see nuns and monks sitting harmoniously on either side of you, yet it hasn't been seen for over 1,000 years. Why are men so reluctant to accept women as their equals, even in Buddhism where it's all about non-self and letting go? What's so threatening about women wanting to live the holy life? Why don't you feel threatened by them? Thanks. It's like, what's threatening about them? And I know, because I work very hard teaching and traveling, I need help. I need all the help I can get, as well as everybody else who's actually teaching Buddhism. So we need women to double our workforce. Why not? And it's just, it's a question. It's like, why on earth are people standing in the way of nuns? And we're not anymore. So, you know, we have sort of all these facilities. And you should be proud of Perth. We are famous, you know, for actually having the bhikkhuni ordination here and going even further. That's 2009 it was, that's 5 years ago, we did the bhikkhuni ordination here, and it did create waves all over the world. But that is not enough. You can ordain them and give ordination, but they have to have a place to stay. They have to have facilities. It's not just doing a ceremony. You need facilities where women can feel accepted, their own place, their own monastery, the same facilities as monks' monasteries have. So that's what we've been doing in Dharamsala the last couple of years, building big hall, accommodation, kitchen and everything else so that they have the facilities they deserve equal to any monks' monastery. And that will be finished in May, the last I heard. An opening, I don't know when, but it's, you know, it'll be just the day before again, probably. But I mean, this is what happens, but it's getting there. So you build facilities, and the next thing, because it's still not done yet, you've got to train the nuns. Because as monks, you know, we have senior monks to do the training of junior monks, and so there's a whole tradition there. For bhikkhunis, it's been dropped, you know, it's been interrupted for 1,000 years. So now the monks have to actually to do that training, which will be usually done by senior bhikkhunis, senior nuns. And that's one of the reasons why, if you look next to cottage number 5, now, next to cottage number 5, there's an open space there. That is where we're going to build the bhikkhuni, the nuns' cottage, in Jhana Grove. So more nuns can come on retreats, not just 2, but, you know, 4. and actually really enhance their meditation. When we have a retreat, they're also learning a lot of Dhamma as well. So we're training them more and more and more until they can be totally independent. And so they'll be sitting here, and the monks will be sitting over there listening to the nuns teaching. And that's when we're done. Okay, we finished now. Now the job has been done. It's not just ordaining them, it's training them, encouraging them, supporting them until they can do the same jobs and seem to do the same jobs as the monks do. We're not there yet, so I don't think it's all done. There's still a long way to go, but we're getting there. And why people don't do that, I mean, it's ridiculous. But one thing I will tell you, that I can't argue with the senior monks. It's just arguing against a brick wall. But you can. Always in Buddhism, you find it's the power of the lay community changes monks' attitudes. Not the intellectual arguments from the sutras or the Vinaya. It's you guys and girls. Now you support those monks and nuns. And actually they listen to you much more than you think. And eventually, if you start giving support to bhikkhunis, they do it over here. But recently, here we go again, I heard that the bhikkhunis in United States, of all places, in California, they had to leave their monastery because it was so badly looked after. There was mold in all of the buildings. And they didn't have a proper place to stay. And for a place like California, which is supposed to be the home of equality and human rights and gender equality and goodness knows what else, that they could allow that to happen, I was disgusted. And so I really sort of used whatever podium I could to say, look, you Buddhists in California, you should look after your bhikkhunis and get them proper places to stay. And that's why in next February I'm going over there to raise funds for them. Yeah, collecting funds here, we're collecting more when I go over there to try and make people embarrassed. These are bhikkhunis. They're this incredible part of Buddhism. And they have to live in places where they're getting mold in their lungs, like one poor nun did. That's dangerous for your health. You should look after people. And instead of building these massive monasteries for monks with lots of chandeliers and lots of gold, becoming tourist places when there are actually people trying to practice and getting mouldy rooms to stay in. There's something wrong about that. And I can say those things, and so I do that and get people to actually get their money out of their pockets and give it to the nuns. So that's what we're doing over there. But still in Thailand. In Thailand, the senior monks say there are no bhikkhunis. There's about 500 of them. What do you mean there's no bhikkhunis? It's very much like there was this politician in Australia, in Queensland, Bob Katter, who said there are no gays in North Queensland. In fact, he said that. There's no homosexuals. He's an absolutely crazy guy. He's just totally blind, just seeing what he wants to see. And that's the same with many senior monks in Thailand. Say there are no bhikkhunis. They're there! And the same in Sri Lanka as well. And there are no bhikkhunis. They're there. So little by little, you guys, say, look, they're there. You support the bhikkhunis. And you make sure that they're looked after. And then when they start to grow, all these senior monks and the politicians, they will jump on the bandwagon. You've got to create the bandwagon first, which we're creating. And then everyone else will jump on it. So anyway, that's how it's going to happen. It's getting there. Saliva. Swallow, spit, or ignore. Okay, the saliva problem. If you have lots of... maybe we can get a collection for one of these, because it always happens in a retreat. To get one of those machines they use in the dentists. The little thing going there. So if we can collect some money, I'll buy one. So in the next retreat, you'll have no saliva problems. Just swallow, for goodness sake, and don't worry about it. You swallow once, swallow twice. After a while, it just disappears. Watching the gap between the in-breath and the out-breath seems working a little bit to keep the mind still. Is this using willpower? is a little bit of willpower, but it's actually using it quite wisely. You know, just keeping a focus and just making it interesting. And in order to help make it interesting, I sometimes give you a test, because people love tests. It makes them more interesting. Find out which is the longer, the gap between the in-breath and the out-breath, or the gap between the out-breath and the in-breath. That's a test for you. So when you give it a test, it makes it interesting. So you start to look at it, you know, which is longer, which means you have to be a bit more mindful. Dear Ajahn Brahm, my lovely mother passed away just over a year ago. She died of a heart attack in another country, so I wasn't able to be with her when she died. I miss her deeply. I thought somehow we should say goodbye in a dream, but she never came to me. I know you say I need to let go, but how do I do it? On the one hand, it's as if I'll never be able to cry enough tears for her. On the other, it's like, if I don't feel sad about her, then I don't really love her, and I do. If you really love someone, you respect them. If you respect them, you do what they would want you to do. Would your mother want you to be sad? Would your mother want you to be cry? She'd probably say, you silly girl, stop crying. Stop it. When I die, will you cry for me? If you do, you are bad disciples. I insist that none of you cry. So please, so be obedient. What are you crying for anyway? You're crying for yourself. You're not crying for your mum. When you realize that, so, well, I'm crying for myself. I'm not crying for my mum. She's gone. She's having a good time. So, you know, what am I sad about? You're only sad for yourself. It's totally selfish. You're not sad about your mum. She's free of her disease. She's gone. And she's having a good time. So, who are you sad for? Well, who are you crying for? When you realize you're crying for yourself, you're sad for yourself, then you realize it's your problem, not your mother's. You have to fix it. One of the great ways is the simile of the concert. When my father died when I was only 16, it shows I was a Buddhist before. When he died when I was only 16, I never cried, I never felt sad, I never cried at his funeral, I never cried since. I never felt sad about my father dying. I loved him, I told many stories about him. The reason was because I looked at his life like a great concert, which had ended. And I went to many concerts as a young man in London. Never once after a great concert did I cry. I never felt sad. I was great concerts for rock bands. The first concert of Led Zeppelin. I saw the Rolling Stone when I was only 11. I saw, who is it? Rod Stewart. You know, there's only six of us saw him in this small room above a pub in North London. Hardly anyone turned up. There's a great bands, great orchestras I remember seeing. And after the music stopped, I realized I would never listen to that music again, probably. But I felt so blessed, so grateful, how lucky I was to have been at that concert. I'll never forget that music ever. You know, I can actually visualize some of those concerts again. Rod Stewart, really young, blonde hair, just a kid. I was a kid as well. All those great concerts I remember seeing. And I look back upon those with gratitude. And that's exactly how I looked at my father's death. 16 years. Thank you so much, Father. That was a brilliant concert. I'll never forget that. Thank you so much. I never felt sadness. I felt as if I'd been blessed by 16 years with a great teacher. So that's actually how I look at life and death. You turn it around. Your mother, you probably had much more than 16 years with her. How lucky you were to have a great mother like that. So look at what you've had, and you never feel sad. Look at what's taken away, and then you may feel sad. But look at what you had. Wow. Thank you so much, Mum. Those memories which will never disappear. Thank you so much. And next, also, I'm so scared of losing my wonderful, gentle husband. I worry because he travels everywhere by motorbike, doesn't exercise, and doesn't eat his vegetables. Much like me. Tell him there's I don't know if there's any vegetarians here, but I figured out a way how vegetarians can eat steak. So you can tell your husband this, how vegetarians can eat steak, and no problem at all. So you take a cow. Any really strict vegetarians here, leave the room now because you're going to get offended. You take a cow, and under anaesthetic you give it the operation called lobotomy. You remove some of the cow's brain. And when the cow comes out from the operation, he's lost so much brain that he's now a vegetable. And therefore... I think of that all by myself. That's how vegetarians can eat cows. They become vegetables. So I let go of this awful fear that something bad would happen to him. Thank you, sorry for so long. Indeed, I mean, it's been ridiculous. How many people, because they eat vegetables and they don't exercise, how many of them die? A lot of them, they live a long, healthy life. It depends not just on what they eat, but their happiness. So, if you're really very afraid, the time you have with your husband now is not high quality time. It's just ruined by fear. So realize that if you're afraid that something's going to go, it means you're not enjoying this present moment. You're afraid of what's going to happen in the future. And the future is so uncertain, you don't know what will happen. So that's why I say that when you want something more, when you fear something in the future, you can't enjoy this present moment. So you're destroying your relationship by being afraid. So just enjoy this moment, live in the present moment. And if you live in this present moment, this is where the future is being made. This is the very best you can do for the future. So enjoy your husband, his presence, being with him. And don't be afraid. And be kind, be gentle, make peace. And you're doing the very, very best for having a wonderful, long life together. Dear Ajahn, I can't help thinking all your reasons for drinking urine hold true for feces. It's from the body and it's testing your ideas of repulsion. Dare I ask? Sometimes I do eat feces. It's absolutely true. I've eaten dog shit. But I dig it under the mango tree first. I wait for a year, and when the mango absorbs all the dog shit, then I eat the processed dog shit, which is mango. That's all mango is. That's what vegetables are. They're processed cow shit. Because that's what they fertilize these things with. So you put them in the fields, they fertilize it with all this dung, and out from that comes your yeah, especially, what's it called, mushrooms. Did you have mushrooms today? That's what it is, that's processed feces. So you ate them as well, I've eaten them as well. So yeah, that's how you do it. But you don't eat them raw, you process them first of all. I'm just thinking on the run here. How to become a trash bin with a hole. Oh, that's a simile that when we all end up as counsellors sooner or later. You know, people come and tell us their problems. And when they tell us your problems, don't sort of take their problems, you know, into your own heart. I have to do that because, look, I became a monk. I realised that things like marriage is suffering and having kids, wow. That is like really being in jail for 20, it's actually more than 20 years now because your kids live at home, you know, longer than 20 years. When I was about 17 or 18, all the kids left home. Now your children stay in home 25, 30, and they're still living at home. Kick them out. Have a bit of peace. You looked after them enough. Birds looking after their young in a nest. As soon as their young can fly, they're out. Out you get. Kick, kick, kick. Find your own nest. Because you mothers and fathers, you work so hard. Don't you want a bit of peace? So anyway, I realized that I didn't want to have kids. I didn't want to have a family. And because I have the peace of being a monk. And then people coming up to me and they tell me all their family problems. I became a monk to get rid of all of that, to avoid that. Now you're dumping it all on me. So, but anyway, I make sure I don't keep anything. Because if you keep things, there's many counsellors, who actually commit suicide. You know, because they listen to what people say and they actually keep it inside. And it sort of, it just stops them being happy, stops enjoying themselves. Because they're so worried about other people's problems and suffering, they can't let it go. And so if you are counselling, you all counsel sooner or later, you have to learn how to be, as Ajahn Chah said, the rubbish bin with a hole in the bottom. And it's a very wonderful simile. So you imagine that, you know, you're a rubbish bin, a hole in the bottom. So people actually give you their problems and you lift them with compassion. You respect them. So you don't just, you know, say, "Are you a stupid person? What are you thinking like that for?" No, you respect them, listen to all their problems, empathize with them, feel their pain. But then as soon as they go, you let everything go out again afterwards. So you're empty for the next person. Because if you keep keeping to the pain of other people, you soon get so full, you can't actually receive and hear someone else's pain. And you can't even see anything else but the pain which is right inside of you, stuffed up from the bottom to the top. And that's when you get very depressed and even suicidal. So it's important, as soon as a person's giving you their pain, you let it go. It's not yours, you shouldn't keep it. It doesn't belong to you. Don't own it, let it go. So you listen, and it goes. You receive everything. And one ways of doing that, you can imagine again yourself like the lotus flower. Just nothing sticks to you. Imagine like a cylinder, a rubbish bin. Everything goes right through you. You don't keep anything. You can imagine, what else can you imagine? You can imagine like after every piece of counselling, you can press a button and it totally disappears. You can delete everything. I call it the delete button inside of you. So you don't keep things. And if you can do that, you find you're a far more effective counsellor. You're open for other people. You've got time for other people. You're not always so full up. And you're also free to be with yourself. So it's important to try and do that if you're in any counselling position. Dear Ajahn, if two people are very close in a lifetime and live most of it together, when one dies, can that stream of consciousness wait for the other to join them? Can the one already dead watch over the other one until he or she dies? Thank you. Yeah, that happens quite often. You know, you get so close together, you're in sync. And I've seen that when one person dies, you know, just a few weeks later, even a few days later, the other person dies. You know, because it's almost as if the will to live has gone, which is also another important part of sustaining your life. And you know, if you lose the will to live, you know, people die very quickly. So that's one of the reasons why that people, when they've lived a long life together for a long time, they die pretty much together. Dear Ajahn Brahm, not so pure-hearted person, if they're able to shine up their nimitta, will they be able to attain jhanas? Yes, they can. You know, you may not be pure-hearted. Maybe your precepts and your generosity may be strong, but if your wisdom is very strong, that can balance it. So this is actually how you use wisdom. Now, your precept, your generosity, your kindness may be a bit weak, but your wisdom can be very strong, and that can push you into the jhanas. When I relax and let go my body and just left the breath, my breath quite short, sometimes fast, uncomfortable feeling in the chest, kindly advise. If you really are relaxing, and you really are letting go, then it means usually there's a comfortable feeling. If there is an uncomfortable feeling left in the chest, then just give it some kindness, soften it, even actually get your hand and start rubbing that area. Whatever it is, to give some metta to that part of the chest. So if the chest needs to move, let it move. Sometimes the body will solve the problem. You just get out of the way and let it happen. I felt lost as I give up the willpower, like not giving any instruction to the mind, but if I instruct to stay clear and still to focus on the breath, it feels better, kindly advised. It might feel better in the short term if you use willpower, but you find it just goes into a direction which is a dead end. It's much better to not give any instruction except just to be kind and be aware, and it may, just like the simile of the carrot and the donkey. The carrot might go further away from you for a little while, but after a while, it starts coming towards you. The old simile of, you know, keeping a bottle of water perfectly still. You know, if I hold it, it gets reasonably still, but it can't get perfectly still. Now, when I put it down, which you know is the right way to keep this perfectly still, it actually moves more when you first put it down. When you first let go, it always is more movement. But soon it gets back to its normal level when I was holding it, and then it gets deeper and gets perfectly still when I let things go. So in this simile, when you first let go, it creates more movement. So when you let go of willpower, it actually gets worse, first of all. But then you stay there, and it soon gets more and more peaceful, more and more peaceful, more and more peaceful. That's why you have to be patient with letting go. At first, you think it's not working. Keep on letting go, then you find it does work. I have bought a few Buddha statues, placing in the meditation room of my apartment. Do I need to invite monks to do blessings to those Buddha statues? Is it a must? What is the use of doing blessings on Buddha statues? Exactly. The only use for inviting the monks to your house to do blessings is so the monks can make more money for their projects. Basically, okay, it's late at night, I'm being honest now. It's just a nice little learner for monks. You don't need to do that. You know, how can a monk bless a Buddha? This is a Buddha. The Buddha should be blessing the monks, not the other way around. I do that every now and again because I'm too lazy to try and explain to people that it's a waste of time. So, because I'm too lazy, I take the Buddha, give it a blessing, give it back to them, they're happy, and it saves me much more time than having to explain it to them. This is a lot of rubbish. Okay, it's true though, that's what I do. So you don't need to do that. Same with the teddy, you don't need to bless the teddy. Suppose I bless the teddy and just put it up here and say, no more trust. You'd think I was crazy, wouldn't you? What's the difference between this teddy bear and a Buddha statue? Maybe what it represents, so you respect the Buddha statue, but blessing it. You shouldn't be blessing a Buddha statue, because a Buddha is much higher than any monk. So it should be blessing me. So just as sort of it's a custom which has grown up. And because it's a custom which has grown up, sometimes we do it to make people feel happy. But it is absolutely unnecessary. You don't need to do that. However, if you have a Buddha statue at home, you must always put it in a respectful place. Because this happened. This is another weird story. This Malaysian family, they got a Buddha statue for their house. And then they came to see me because they were really spooked. They put it in their hallway. And when they came the following morning after sleeping the night, the Buddha statue had turned. And the woman thought, oh no, somebody must have knocked it. She straightened it, and the next morning it turned again. And she asked her kids, did any of you turn it? No, no, we didn't do anything, Mum. So she turned it straight again, and the third morning it turned again. And that's when she was so afraid she came to see me. No one had touched it. It had turned by itself. You know what was happening? It was facing a mirror. And it decided it didn't want to. And it had turned all by itself. Sometimes Buddha statues do strange things. When we first built our hall in Serpentine, in Bodhinyana Monastery, we put that big Buddha statue in there, and when the Thai people came, they complained. They say that Buddha statue is facing west. Buddha statues are supposed to face east. And they really criticized Ajahn Chakra. Stupid monk, he should know better than that. Buddha statues have to face east. And when a senior Thai monk came, they really brought it up, said, what should we do? Ajahn Chakra has put the Buddha statue facing the wrong way. And the senior Thai monk said, don't need to worry. If the Buddha wanted to turn around, he'd have turned around already by now. That was a great answer. It got Ajahn Chakra out of a mess. So he didn't need to turn it around again. So, and anyway, the reason why it's facing west, because this is, you know, down under. You know, we do things the opposite way round down here. So, you know, that's why it's facing west, because it's, you know, down under. The same if you see those two lions at the entrance to Jarna Grove. They came from Indonesia. You know, they're protecting or welcoming lions. And we put them around the wrong way. One is a male, one is a female, and they should be the opposite way around. So when the person who gave these to us, they came to visit, they said, "You've got them the wrong way around." I said, "Of course, because it's down under, you know, opposite way around." And he said, "Ajahn Brahm, you should be a politician. You've got an answer for everything." Okay, the last question before we go to bed. Oh, crikey. Can't we have a nice, easy question at the end? Does consciousness see or know impermanence? How could it if it's impermanent? How can inference permanently destroy craving? Okay. Now that question, how can consciousness see impermanence? I will demonstrate it to you. You are conscious of this piece of paper. Now it's disappeared. Your consciousness has now seen impermanence. You've done it. How can consciousness see impermanence? Just like that. Good night. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And now you see me impermanent. I'm disappearing. I've had enough. Thank you very much for those questions.